Socialism. Does the Bible teach socialism? Well, we're going to discuss that today in the episode that's on the book Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. Subtitle is How the Deep State Capitalizes on Crises to Consolidate Control. And I'm Bill Federer, and this information is also available on a website, AmericanMinute.com. Well, now, did the early church, what, weren't they socialist? They owned everything in common. Well, let's look a little closer. In the early church, they sold their property and they brought the money to the feet of the apostles for the church to distribute. They didn't have their property taken away, and they were forced to put the money at the feet of Pilate for the Roman government to redistribute. So we see a difference that the early church was one that was voluntary, and socialism is involuntary. And then also we see that the early believers, they laid the money at the feet of the church to distribute, whereas socialism, it's the government that does the redistributing. And we're going to see that those two changes from voluntary to involuntary and church to government are very significant. Well, the Bible, it is quite possibly the most ancient book that has been widely distributed throughout history. Matter of fact, when you look at the best-selling books of all times, that the Bible is the best-selling book out of all books. If it were to be on the New York Times bestseller list, it would be on the top of the list every single time. There are more copies of the Bible that are distributed than any other book. So let's look at this book. In the Bible, there are commands given to five main groups. There are commands to individuals, to families, to business, to church, and then to government. The commands to the individual, among other things, include taking care of the poor. The commands to the family, those are mostly relational. Husbands, love your wives. Children, submit to your parents. There is a command that says, take care of your relative or you're worse than an infidel, but it's not generally for poor. The business commands, those are things like do an honest day's work and employer, don't hold back the wages. There is a command that says, leave the gleanings, the corners of your field for the poor people to pick through. But the church is definitely commanded to take care of the poor, and immediately they did. The book of Acts says that they immediately started feeding the orphans and the widows. And then, over time, they began to start medical clinics and hospitals and orphanages and would work to start schools and all the disadvantaged they would help. And then, you know, the Second Great Awakening in America fueled the abolitionist movement to end slavery. And so we see the church has always been involved in doing things, taking care of the poor. Did you know there's no command in the Bible for the government to take care of the poor? The command to the government is the shortest. Protect the innocent, punish the guilty. There's no command for the government to be involved in health care. There's no command for the government to be involved in education. What's happened is the government has usurped the church's role. And even all the way through the 1930s and 40s and in America, it was the government that just did two things, you know, defend the country and to protect the innocent, punish the guilty. It was the church that had all these. It was the church that started hospitals. There's a book that I put together called Miraculous Milestones in Science, Medicine, and Innovation, and it documents Christian contributions to the scientific revolution. Kepler, Copernicus, Galileo, Isaac Newton, they all believed in a creator. But it was Christians that came up with the idea of hospitals, right? So it wasn't Islam that came up with that idea. It wasn't Hinduism that had the lowest caste being the untouchables that would, if they're dying in the gutter, it's because they sinned in a past life. And if you really care about them, you'll let them suffer so they'll be reincarnated in a higher is a caste in their next life, and so there was no motivation to do health care for the poor there. China had 5,000 years of emperors, and they had a pyramid structure where if you're friends with the emperor, you're more equal, and you're not friends, you're less equal. And of course, at the bottom, they had the slaves. Wherever you have kings on top, you have slaves on the bottom. But it was Jesus who said the parable of the Good Samaritan. The person was beat up on the side of the road, and the stranger comes along and doctors him up, pours in oil and wine, takes him to an inn, and says, I'll pay you more when I get back. And he said, whatever you do to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. And he said, at the last judgment, dividing the sheep and the goats. And the people say, well, when, Lord, were you sick and we visited you? And so it's this idea of that it was the Christians having this responsibility. So immediately they started hospitals. They'd go on pilgrimages to the Holy Land and show up sort of worn out. And so every place where they were making a pilgrimage to, they would set up an infirmary to convalesce, right? Get your strength back. And the word for pilgrim or traveler is hosp, H-O-S-P. It's where you get the word hospitality for strangers, right? And so hospital were where these travelers, these pilgrims would rest and recuperate. And so those turned into hospitals. It was Christians that invented hospitals through the Middle Ages and through all kinds of orders of nuns that would dedicate their lives to taking care of the sick. And why do I bring that out? Is because really it's been a fairly recent phenomenon for the government to get into taking care of healthcare. But if you want to go to other countries, third world countries, and it's the missionaries that go over there that start the hospitals. It's the missionaries that go over there and start the schools. And that's sort of the way it was in America, that it was the Christian missionaries that would start these different things. So the government has been usurping the church's role and getting involved in health care and education. James Madison, he's sometimes referred to as the architect of the Constitution. He wrote in 1794, he says, charity is no part of the legislative duty of the government. Really? Yeah, he helped write the Constitution. And then another interesting story is Davy Crockett. Before he dies in the Alamo, he was a U.S. congressman. And he's there in Washington, D.C., and there, he was from Tennessee, and there was a situation of a fire, and some houses burnt, and one of them belonged to this lady who was very helpful to the founders in D.C., and so they were going to vote to have Congress put up the money to help to reimburse her for her damages for her house burning. And they were going to vote on it, and Davy Crockett said, no. And this is what he said. Congress has not the power to appropriate this money as an act of charity. Every member on this floor knows it. We have the right as individuals to give away as much of our own money as we please in charity. But as members of Congress, we have no right to appropriate a dollar of public money as charity. Right? So we begin to see that the government giving away money is not charitable. Calvin Coolidge, who was a president in 1926, he said, it does not follow that because something ought to be done, the national government ought to do it. We need to take care of the poor, yes, but it's not the government's job. We need to take care of the immigrants, yes, but it's not the government's job. We need to take care of the sick, yes, but it's not the government. And so Gerald Ford said in 1976, people say, why don't you expand that program and spend more federal money? I look them in the eye and say, do you realize that a government big enough to give us everything we want is a government big enough to take from us everything we have? Right? So if you want the government to take care of everything, yes, it will, but it'll control your life. And so now when the church helps people, it is called disinterested benevolence. That you want to help people for no other reason than you want to help them, and hopefully they'll get better off and they'll help the next needy person that comes along, right? And this body of Christ can grow of everybody caring for each other. Whenever the government helps anybody, it's always in exchange for something. You're in Egypt, you're starving, the government says we'll give you some grain, but it's in exchange for your land, your cattle, your children, your lives, right? Your vote, control over your life. There's the saying, he who holds the purse strings has the power. If the government's in the business of distributing stuff to people, it can decide who doesn't get it. And now when the church helps, the giver feels the joy of the Lord in their heart for helping out a person in need. And you've felt that. But when the recipient of the gift, they experience this love and care from a real person, and they are thankful for it, and it develops a relationship, and they can realize, gee, God is a real person that cares about me. Whenever the government helps anybody, it's impersonal. You don't know whose money that was taken from their paycheck to give you your welfare check. You don't know, and you don't care. And instead of being grateful, the recipient ends up thinking it as a debt that's owed to them. And over time, they would get upset if it's delayed or discontinued. It's a phenomenon. It's a way that we as humans experience it. And over time, if someone is receiving this free stuff for a long enough period of time, it eats away at their self-esteem. They see other people being successful, and they think, gee, I'm just receiving this. And they want to channel that negative feeling somewhere. And they end up blaming the very government that's giving them free stuff. They end up hating the very government that's giving them free stuff. It's a strange phenomenon. Well, now the pilgrims. They originally, when we're in America, they were a company colony, and everything was owned in common, and nobody wanted to work, and the young man objected to doing twice as much work as the old guy, but got paid the same, and the women objected to having to wash other men's clothes, and they almost starved to death because nobody wanted to plant, and William Bradford said, let's scrap this and give everybody their own plot of land. He said, this made all hands more industrious. The women now went willingly into the field, took their little ones with them to plant corn, and why? Because they got what grew. And so the pilgrims switched from company to covenant. They switched from a government redistributing of wealth that nobody had any say in, it's just in these bylaws, to, no, you get your own stuff and you can be moved upon to be charitable and give away some of your stuff. So your neighbor is being taken care of, but instead of it being impersonally by these bylaws, it's personally by you being moved upon and being charitable. And so this switch from involuntary to voluntary, this switch from company to covenant is worth examining. So the covenant form of government is like a triangle. You get rights and blessings from God. You take care of your neighbor voluntarily. Why? Because you're accountable to God. Jesus says, whatever you do to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. And so this was really studied by the founders of America, especially during the colonial age. So Martin Luther starts the Reformation in 1517, and he translates the Bible into German. And then you have William Tyndale and others translating the Bible into English, and it's being translated. And so these scholars in Europe are really thrilled that they can read the Bible in their own language. But then they begin to gravitate toward a particular part of the Bible. And they studied that first 400-year period when Israel came out of Egypt before they got King Saul. It's called the Hebrew Republic. And it's an anomaly in world history. So one of the projects I had years ago was I researched every civilization that's ever existed on planet Earth, all the way back to the beginning of the invention of writing. Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley around 3300 BC. And from the beginning of writing, the most common form of government is kings. Nimrod, pharaohs, sultans, czars, Maharaja, Genghis Khan, Julius Caesar, Attila the Hun. And as the centuries go on, the kingdoms get bigger, because with military advancements, the king can kill more people. So instead of killing with a rock like Cain killed Abel, they can kill with a bronze weapon or an iron weapon or a big long phalanx spear that the Greeks had, or a composite bow that the Mongols had and the Huns, or a gunpowder that the Chinese invented. The weapon improves, but it's that same fallen nature. St. Augustine called it libido dominandi, the lust to dominate. And so what we see is the norm is kings. What's rare is people getting a chance to rule themselves without a king. And the first major recorded instance of this was ancient Israel. around 1400 BC, give or take a century or so, they came out of Egypt and they come into the promised land. And for the first 400 years, there is no king. They are all equal. And the law says that with God, there is no respect of persons in judgment. Rich or poor, everyone's to be treated the same. This is the beginning of the concept of equality on planet Earth. And so this was studied, this period of time called the Hebrew Republic, and the Christian scholars at this time were called Christian Hebraists. And they would study this Hebrew period of time, that first 400 years. And so the pilgrims studied this, and then the Puritans studied it. Matter of fact, when they founded Harvard and Yale, they taught Hebrew, right? Well, why else would they teach this dead language that had been gone for a couple thousand years? But yet here at Harvard and Yale, they're teaching Hebrew. Matter of fact, to this day, Yale has Hebrew characters on its coat of arms. And so we see this first 400-year period when Israel came out of Egypt. And there's about a dozen unique aspects to this. The first is, as I mentioned, it's the beginning of the concept of equality. Wherever you have a king, wherever you have a deep state government, if you're friends with those at the top, you're a little more equal. You're politically connected. If you're not their friends, you're less equal. And then if you're at the bottom of the pyramid, you're a slave, right? Or you're dead. So wherever you have kings on top, you have slaves on the bottom. I thought that slavery started in 1619. It's like, no, you go all the way back. Even Hammurabi's code, 1800 BC, is a contemporary of Abraham. In his code, he writes, okay, you got the king, you got the royal class, you got the military class, you got the merchant class, the peasant class, and at the bottom you have the slaves, right? So it's documented. Wherever you have kings on top, you have slaves on the bottom. And so when Israel comes out of Egypt for the first 400 years, there's no king, and everyone is equal. And the law says there's no respect to persons in judgment. And then another aspect of this ancient Israel period was here they were worshiping the one true God, and they never felt compelled to force anybody to worship him. They had strangers amongst them, but they didn't make the stranger grab a lamb and drag it to the temple. You could convert if you wanted to, but they didn't force you. So it's the beginning of the concept of tolerance, that your worship of God is only pleasing to God if it's voluntarily given. And it's based on this concept of love that's explored more in the New Testament, where God loves you. He wants you to love him back. He doesn't need your love, but he wants it. Sort of like parents don't need the love of their kids, but they want it, right? And so God doesn't need your love, but he wants it. And love, by definition, must be voluntary. If God forced you to love him, he himself would know he's forcing you to love him, and he would know your response is not a love response. So he gives you this free choice. Anyway, so ancient Israel, here they were tolerant. They didn't force anybody to convert. Ancient Israel was the first place on the planet where you had a nation of people that had private land ownership. You think, really? Yeah, wherever you have a king, your ownership of land is always conditional of you staying on the nice side of the king. You cross the king, he will take away your land and kill you. But in ancient Israel, the land was permanently titled to each family. If you own land, you can accumulate stuff. And the Bible called that being blessed. And you can be moved upon to give away some of your stuff. The Bible called that charity. Ancient Israel had no police. Everyone was taught the law, and everyone helped enforce the law. It was like everybody was deputized. We have a little of that today with traffic laws. If somebody cuts you off, you'll honk the horn. You take it upon yourself, right? It's sort of like a mom watching a bunch of neighborhood kids. She has no problem correcting somebody else's kid. In ancient Israel, everybody corrected everybody else all the time. It was a self-policing system. It was sort of like, you know, in your body, you have white blood cells and they'll, you know, correct if there's any infection there. They don't wait for a nerve signal from your brain. They just all respond. But in ancient Israel, everybody helped enforce the law. And the children. In the book, Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present, I talk about how Plato says that the philosopher king, the tyrant, will take the children away from the parents and indoctrinate them with noble lies. And it's this idea that he wants to program the kids. But in the Bible, the children are taught the law of God from being in, you know, young kids. And so they would have their Hebrew schools, Genesis, where it got said, God chose Abraham. He says, I know him because he will teach his children to keep the ways of the Lord, to do justice and judgment. So the idea of the parent passing on this knowledge to the kids. Deuteronomy 4:9, teach them to your children and grandchildren. Deuteronomy 4:10, but teach them to the sons and thy sons' sons. And Deuteronomy 6:7, and you shall teach them diligently to your children. You know, when the Huns invaded Europe, they asked them where they came from, and all they could do was point to the east. They didn't know who they were. They didn't know where they came from. They were just, there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of them on horses that would just go through and, you know, pillage and steal and so forth. And but God chose Abraham because he knew he would pass this. It's not a genetic code. It's a philosophy of life. It's a teaching. It's the word of God to his children. So ancient Israel, we have these different points. Everyone's equal, they're tolerant, everyone owns private property, they help enforce the law, there's no police, the children are taught the law. There's no standing army in ancient Israel that first 400 years. Why? Because every man was in the militia, and every man was armed with a sword upon their thigh, and they were ready at a moment's notice to defend their family and their community. And ancient Israel had no prisons. You think, really? Well, yeah, in Egypt, remember Joseph was in prison for several years? But in Israel, when a crime was committed, you immediately got the accused and the elders, and you went to the gates of the city, and you had the trial right then. Ancient Israel had a bureaucracy-free welfare system. What's that? So in Egypt, people were selling their souls to the Pharaoh for a handout of grain. But in Israel, when you harvested your field, you left the gleanings, the corners, for the poor people to pick through, like Ruth. This way, the poor were taken care of on a cellular level, so to speak, right? Everybody took care of them without some central nervous system, some big centralized government leader taking away everything and dispensing it back out in exchange for votes or exchange for control of their lives. And then Israel had a system of honesty. God hates unjust weights and measures, so everybody would deal honestly, and this was the basis for commerce. You could trust people in business. And then Israel got to choose their own leaders. And you think, really? Here is Moses, and Deuteronomy 1:3, it says, Moses spake unto the children of Israel, how can I myself alone bear your burden? Take you wise men and understanding and known among your tribes, and I'll make them rulers over you. So you know the people in your tribe that hate covetousness and they just can't be bribed and they're honest. And you basically said, bring them to me and I'll make them your leaders. And so it was an election process within the tribe. So every village had a synagogue, a meeting house, where they would elect their city elders. And then they would elect elders to go to the tribal meeting. And the tribe would elect people to go to the Sanhedrin, the 70. And it was a bottom up. But anyone in ancient Israel could be chosen and raised up into leadership. And there's stories of the judges. Here's Gideon from a nobody family, and he's raised up as a leader. Here's Deborah, a woman. She becomes a national leader in Israel, not because she's related to royalty. She just knows the law. She's honest. The reputation spreads. She sits under a tree, and people make their way all the way across the country to let her hear their case and tell them what the law says. Where else in the world could a woman become a national leader who's not related to royalty? There was a Harvard president, Samuel Langdon, and at the New Hampshire ratifying convention, and they're debating whether or not to ratify the Constitution, he gives an address, and he says, the Israelites may be considered as a pattern to the world in all ages of government on Republican principles, from abject slavery, a mere mob, to a well-regulated nation under laws far superior to what any other nation could boast. Think of it. They're a mob. They're slaves for 400 years, and suddenly they get downloaded this completely unique system that doesn't have a king, and it works because every citizen is taught the law. And then one of the most interesting is ancient Israel was the first nation that could read. And so Sumeria had 1,500 cuneiform characters. It was only for court records. Egypt had 3,000 hieroglyphic characters. It's only for court records. It's only for the Pharaoh and the scribes. Only 1% of Egypt could read. The scribes kept them complicated on purpose as job security. They were needed as a class to interpret these complicated hieroglyphs. China had 10,000 characters, and again, just for court records, only for the emperor and the scribes. Only the upper class could read. It was like the deep state. They knew what was going on, and nobody else did, and the common people were ignorant. And so when Moses comes down the mountain, he does not just have the law. He has the law in a 22-character alphabet. First letter's Aleph, second letter Beth. It is so easy to learn, kids could learn it. No longer is reading and writing this ruling class knowledge. Everybody could read. So ancient Israel was this model where you empower and educate the people, and then the people rule themselves without a king. Anyway, so we've been talking about the book Socialism, and instead of the Bible model is that you're voluntarily taking care of your neighbor, whereas the socialism model is the government involuntarily takes your stuff and redistributes it. It's a very important topic that we discuss. It's in the book called Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present, and the subtitle is How the Deep State Capitalizes on Crises to Consolidate Control. And this is available on the website, AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. Makes a great gift. If you get the book, you can email on the inside and get it as a PDF file. But I want to thank you for watching. God bless.